Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very honored to have your attention this evening. I know I've enjoyed hearing many of you speak on Wednesday evenings over the last few years, and you all set a very high bar. Tonight, I'm giving a way-seeking mind talk. So it will be part potted biography, part sharing of reflections and insights, and part forward-looking aspirations. Talking about yourself is not generally compatible with what you might call British reserve. But I remind myself how much I've enjoyed similar talks as a way of better getting to know many of you. So I'm suppressing that cultural foible for the evening and will share openly with you all. To tell you a little about who I am, my first thoughts are to describe the family that I grew up with, even though for many years we have now lived thousands of miles apart. I am the oldest of three children, all very close in age, and we are the oldest of our generation in our family. So all our cousins, both my parents' sides, are younger even than my baby sister who just turned 40, and my family is Scottish. I mostly grew up in Scotland's largest city, Glasgow, although for a spell as a toddler, I lived here in the Bay Area. And briefly, even right where Canando is in Mountain View, before settling in Cupertino for a couple of years. And my brother was born here. We lived in Switzerland for a few years. My sister was born there. And finally, we moved back to the UK, back to Scotland, when I was about 8 years old. And I would say I was a very bright and loving kid and spectacularly naive. I thought my parents were the most talented people alive and that where I lived was the center of the world. We were financially stable, but I thought that we were rich. I had zero street smarts and was in no way stylish or sophisticated. I was curious and unpolished and maybe intellectually a little bit grown up or precocious, but socially I was very raw. I don't think it crossed my mind too much that I should adapt my behavior to conform to other people's expectations. I was deeply, deeply uncool. I breezed through schoolwork without needing to try, and I was a total goody two shoes teacher's pet. And that can be a rough ride for a kid. I was alone quite a lot at school. I was horribly bullied for many years. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-teens that something shifted. I was somehow a bit more compatible with regular other people and made some decent friends. And it's never been a problem since. Most people would probably think of me as a pretty sociable chap, but I've still carried within me that sense of being on the periphery, being a bit other for much of my life. And I remember as a kid, I would often lie on the floor and stare at the light bulb, which I really can't recommend. And I would try to create this sense that I was drawing energy from it, like there was a special connection between me and the world. And when I was a little bit older, I thought back to that and wrote it off as this childish fantasy and felt rather embarrassed about it. And now I'm not so sure that it was all that dumb at all. Maybe I was onto something. And now I stare at the wall or at the ground, but I feel like there's something similar in the intent. I think that there is and there was way-seeking mind in there. You need to skip forward about 30 years for the meat of my way-seeking mind story, which is largely defined by my time at Canando. So this is a story about and inspired by all of you. In preparing for this talk, I did some research on the internet about way-seeking mind talks. I found this quote from 2013 that at first I didn't recognize as being from our very own sewing teacher, Valerie Beer, who was Eno at the San Francisco Zen Center at the time. And she had this to say about way-seeking mind talks. She said, "People don't usually end up on the cushion because their life is going swimmingly. They end up there because they're drowning in suffering." And it's true that I didn't first come to Canando looking for spiritual practice. I came looking for relief. In early 2018, very shortly after turning 40, I started taking medication to lower my cholesterol. And a few weeks later, out of nowhere, one Monday morning on a work trip to Seattle, I felt a sense of unease arising out of nowhere, and it lasted for a few hours before it went away. And a few days later, it happened again. And over the course of a few weeks, the feelings of anxiety became stronger and lasted longer until there was no retreat. It was my constant companion. And less than a month after that first morning of unease, I went to see my doctor. And a few days later, I stopped going to work for about a month. And I didn't know at that point that the cholesterol medication was doing this to me. And in fact, it would be a year and a half before my spidey sense somehow helped me draw the connection and stop taking the medication, finally start to find that specific relief that I had been looking for. But a year or so before that realization, and a few months into that very confusing and distressing journey, I first came to Canando. Among the battery of options I was pursuing to feel better, I'd been seeing a counselor, and as luck would have it, she had been a longtime member of Canando. And she sort of politely suggested that 10-minute stints on the Headspace app were a BS approach to meditation, and that if I really wanted to get into meditation, I should go to Canando. And there was an intro to Zen session that Saturday, and along I went. That was August 4th, 2018. And I will say that I didn't immediately fall straight in love with Canando. I remember thinking, these are not my people. And a lot of you seemed, to be honest, a bit weird. And you didn't engage each other in the way that I was used to. And it sometimes made me a little uncomfortable. But I kept on coming. And many of those same weirdos are still here. And many of them are here on Zoom tonight. And the love that I have found for you and your weirdness is a treasure. Canando is an unassumingly magical place. At this point, it's been over a year since any of us could regularly visit and practice there. But I have the most acute, rich memories of it. Beyond the people and the teaching, I think that there's something about the physical embodiment of the place and its practice that is transformative for the people that visit regularly. I remember tying my shoelaces in the sun outside the Zendo, talking to Dan Geiger after the first time I sat a full session of Zazen at lunchtime on a day off work. I remember the surprise and the beauty I felt the first time I heard the robe chant at the end of a morning sitting of Zazen in the Zendo. I remember the shock the first time I went for a 5:30 Zazen sitting on a Saturday to find at the end that everyone was sitting back down to do another excruciating.
I remember my first time being full of frustration and wondering what I was frustrating for or to, and wondering if there was some kind of softness or duplicity.
And I remember doing more prostrations over subsequent weeks and months, and the breath coming in and out, and the smell of the cushion, and its feeling on my forehead, and feeling raw and grounded. And I remember casting glances at the altar when I passed it during Kinhin, curious about everything that sat there and what it all meant. And I remember breakfast in the Sangha house. I remember the clutter of people navigating clumsily around each other in the kitchen. I remember the dark table and the simple cutlery and paper napkins sitting on it, and people standing behind folding chairs, waiting quietly for everything to be ready, and passing dishes around the table, assembling a never-before-seen, never-to-be-seen-again assortment, foods being brought together by the people at the table. And I could go on. I remember a lot, tiny details, heavy with feeling. But I want to pause a moment on the food, because I think it says a lot about Canon Do and about Sangha. Everyone brings their unique contribution. We lay it on the table. We all take a piece from each other. We put those pieces inside ourselves. We take them away with us when we leave, and they become a part of us. And we do this again and again, over and over, until we're all rich with each other. And it's, for me, the most beautiful analogy for Sangha. And I remember the day it struck me, sitting one sunny Saturday in the Zendo, and how it lifted my heart. And that's how I came to visit Canon Do. And it's a sampling of the glimpses that caught my heart's attention and kept me coming back long enough to reignite a way-seeking mind that was dormant and lost, smothered in an easy life. On many dimensions, I've had a happy, privileged, fortunate life. I've had great friends. I've been employed and worked that I've largely enjoyed, and it's given me a platform to travel the world. In my 20s and 30s, I had the means and the time to feed a thoroughly enjoyable lifestyle, mostly free of major worries. And this year, I will mark 20 years with my now husband, Rick. And we have two beautiful children, Louis and Audrey, who are full of life and their own characters. And I'm so, so grateful for all of this. And while I've worked hard for many parts of it, a lot of it has fallen in my lap. My appreciation for it all can be quite shallow. My appreciation for the basic existence of things, for the absolute nature of reality, is not even a fraction of what my practice helps me sense it can be. Because the world is amazing. The very existence of our lives and the life that exists around us and inside us is extraordinary. And it's all too easy to sail through life without ever really seeing what's right before your eyes. And this failure to see causes such suffering. It causes suffering directly, personally, and it causes cascading suffering across continents and across generations because of the delusion and the greed that result from failing to see. And so I stay at Canon Do and I commit to my practice because I've come to realize that the kind of suffering that brought me here was just one thin, sharp, superficial layer of suffering. And the kind of peace, the relief that I was seeking was also just one thin, superficial, transient layer. Even in my privileged life, there was then and there remains now uncertainty and suffering. So I want to slow right then, to feel the world, to succumb to uncertainty and impermanence, to dive deep into my own suffering and that of others, to feel new love and to connect. This is easier said than done. With busy lives and jobs and families, the world at large around us, it can be hard find the time, the peace, the right frame of mind to see the world just so. One of the chants at our Saturday services is the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, and it describes the tricky and elusive nature of thusness. It says this: in its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. A hair's breadth deviation will fail to accord with the proper attunement. A hair's breadth deviation will hold you back from tuning in. Walking a hair's breadth tightrope, living a monk's life, or as you enter the Zendo, is one thing. But walking a hair's breadth tightrope when you're in meetings at work or trying to get the kids to put their shoes on, that is another, and it's a tall ask. But we try and do it anyway. Daily sitting practice helps remind you what happens when you slow down, sit still, and open up, and helps remind you to bring your Zazen practice with you when you stand up from the cushion. When your mind is small and tight, the ceaseless jabbering inside it feels so close and so loud. It feels like it's everything, like it's all that you are. And when your mind becomes larger and more expansive, the jabbering maybe doesn't change so much, but it's not so loud. And you realize it's far from being everything. There is room to offer it and yourself compassion. Compassion is a big deal. Before this recent chapter in my life, I understood the dictionary definition, but I don't think I had a true appreciation for compassion. Practice has helped me find a taste of compassion, enough to know when it's there and when it's missing, and to work on refinding it over and over for myself and for others. Refinding compassion is not some abstract notion. It's like those moments when you're sitting on the cushion and you find your mind has wandered, and so you gently bring it back. When you find your compassion has wandered any time in your life, you must also gently bring it back. This never stops. Every bringing back is not so much a reflection of your failed compassion the moment before. It's a reflection of your growing compassion the moment after, and along the timeline of your life. Very happily, I have found that there's something very common around that helps nudge me back on track and find my balance on that hair's breadth tightrope. And that thing is trees. There is something about trees, especially larger trees standing alone, or trees with clearly visible branches against the sky, that helps me to see. Trees in a park, all bent in the same direction by the wind. Trees just expressing their nature, growing from the ground, reaching for the sun, being a tree. I first came to Canada at the age of 40, so let's call it 20 years into my adult life. So I have reason to hope that maybe only a quarter or a third of my adult life has passed. There's a lot of it left. I want to live it well and purposefully and with open eyes and heart. So here's my master plan for the next 40 or 60 years. Slow down. Have moments of stillness. Grow compassion. Face my own suffering. Share others' suffering. Have more moments of stillness. Grow more compassion. Open and breathe. Thank you.
You mentioned that the culture at Canindo is a lot different than the culture in your family or your friends. So I was wondering, do you feel that you can bring your whole self to Canindo? Or do you feel like Canindo touches a part of you, but then there's other aspects that really can only be with family or friends? And do you feel in a way divided?
yeah, I feel I can bring my whole self. And the jarring kind of initial response that I described was partly a function of, so if I think about a Wednesday night talk in the Zendo, and everybody's there in person, somebody might be sitting up there being themselves, being human, maybe making little funny jokes or whatever. And you're used to kind of social niceties where people are trying to engage with that and respond to it and signal to each other how they're feeling or that they're engaged. And quite a lot of the time, I noticed that wasn't there. And it was almost like the speaker was being ignored. And I think it was more in retrospect that, you know, people were coming out of 40 minutes of Zazen and still in a sort of meditative state and appreciating and engaging with it in different ways. But as a social environment, it was like super alien. And I think also, I see a lot of people bringing their whole selves to Canando, sometimes in a pretty unfiltered way. Not in a bad way. I'm just saying, I think to your question about do I feel like I can't bring my whole self? I think I can, and I think I see other people do it too. And so that in itself, if people are being fully themselves, can be a bit strange. It's just not what you're used to when people are modifying themselves, like we all do in most of our lives. And actually from the loving kindness meditation, there's that line about upright, strenuous and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. I do remember thinking, maybe still do, sometimes we can dial up the easily contented and joyous part. Because yeah, there can be a lot of the strenuous, upright, sincere. But I've really come to appreciate everybody's individual characters. And like, I remember sitting in the Zazen on Saturday mornings, and you can tell who's coming in at different points by like the stomp of their feet or the jangle of their keys. And at first I would think that was distracting, and why isn't everything quiet? And then I don't know, over time I actually came to quite appreciate those things. I look forward.
I think we have Travis.
Craig, thank you for your talk. Can you tell us a little bit about those first meaningful relationships you were talking about that you formed in your mid-teens?
I was in high school. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what changed. It's a really hard question. Maybe just describing the fact, I basically ended up going from a position of having extremely few, close to no, like real friends, people I would socialize with at school. I would generally interact more with adults or with teachers, find other stuff to do, keep busy. And when I was around kind of like 15 or so, I guess being diligent or actually trying to do stuff at school wasn't quite so frowned upon or belittled. And there were just a nice crew of people, small group of friends that I actually felt like I had, you know, formed real friendships with. And I remember it being kind of surprising and thrilling in some ways, like the kind of very strange. Yeah, I've always liked helping people and interacting, even just like telling someone the time, like, yes, I was able to do that thing for that person. So it was, I can't really kind of describe what changed because I don't really know. I guess maybe people, like kids that age, were just growing up. Maybe I wasn't compatible as with younger kids. And I'm still in touch with a handful of those people, actually. They're very far away. They're pretty much all in Scotland. I guess I'm glad I turned that corner, because I don't think I would be happy as an adult if that kind of sense of like extreme otherness or isolation had continued beyond then. It was quite hard going.
I had similar experience, and you know, that's one of the things that I hope for my teenagers now. I think they're on their way, but thank you for that. That was wonderful. And if you ever want to see big trees, you can come up to Calaveras County to Big Tree State Park.
That sounds amazing. I would love to.
You're welcome anytime.
Next, we have Mike and then Dave.
Hi, Craig. Thank you very much for your talk. I found it very inspiring. My question is concerns what reason did you have for initially wanting to come to Canandaigua? I remember you saying that you had side effects of a cholesterol drug and one of the members of the Sangha convinced you to come to Canandaigua. But what was your own personal reason? Was it a curiosity of Canandaigua or Zen Buddhism or a desire to attenuate suffering? Or what was the initial spark that really motivated you to go to Canandaigua?
I had no prior well-articulated interest in Buddhism, in religion or kind of spiritual practice in general. In fact, I would say I was a kind of lifelong skeptic, very kind of all about the science sort of thing. So it was just that, like, I guess I was, but on the one hand, I was looking for ways to try and feel better. And having been directed, I will say that this person had actually, she'd been at Canandaigua for a long time, had kind of withdrawn after about 20 years, I'm not sure why. And so she pointed me in that direction. And I was ready to hear it, I guess. There was something appealing about it. I was expecting it to be more just about meditation and meditative practice. And the whole Buddhist thing, the whole Zen thing, just kind of caught me up along the way. And one thing that's interesting is when I was 18, in the year between high school and university, I took a year off. I went to India and I was teaching English in a Buddhist monastery, in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery, for 6 months. And so I was living with these monks aged from like 9 to 90, doing a really horrible job of teaching them English with a Scottish accent. And, you know, it was fascinating in many ways. They would do their very different kind of chanting, I guess, from the kind of stuff that perhaps we do, and make their sand mandalas. And occasionally, when I was stopping for puja, we will resume classes when we've said this prayer 8 billion times, come back in 10 days or whatever, however long it takes. And it was in the Himalayas, and it was, you know, I'd just turned 18, I'd spent my life in Scotland, I was still this, you know, very unstreet-wise kid that I described. So there was a lot of new experience there for me, and it's very exciting. I actually remember being kind of a bit disappointed I was being placed in a religious, in a monastery rather than in a school. Really dismissive of it, and it didn't kind of catch me then. Yeah, again, you know, there were other opportunities, and I think just something about this intersection of place and time and openness, and I think also like the elapsing of 20 years of having done a bunch of fun stuff, of having a great family, but still feeling like I was a bit directionless and just kind of working towards this very loose, arbitrary notion of success in your career or in your life, but it's all very fuzzy. And started to get more of a compass, I guess, from the practice and a sense that there was some kind of real underlying truth about something. I guess I never really believed in that before. So yeah, I just started showing up and sitting and bowing and chanting, and I'm still here. And I guess that was the point about the physical embodiment thing, something about the whole mix of it, you know, turned the key. Thanks, Mike.
Next, we have Dave and then Diane.
Well, again, thank you for your talk, Craig. Over the years, I've heard quite a few way-seeking mind talks, and I can't recall one that shines so much light on the actual process of first coming to Canando, the sort of limited perception of it that one has on first walking in the door, and, you know, what is this going on here anyway? What does this have to do with me? And I remember for the first, I don't know, year or two of my practice, wondering about a couple of conflicting ideas. One is that feeling that the reasons that I first started doing this are not exactly the same reasons why I keep coming back. It almost felt like I had done a sort of bait and switch on myself, where I came with a gaining idea. I wanted to solve this problem. I wanted to have more control. I wanted to reduce this stress. And I gradually came to realize that, as Suzuki Roshi says, the point of our practice is to continue our practice. So that idea that you sort of come in the door with reasons that are, if not entirely the wrong reasons, at least maybe reasons that are too small. I was trying to put that together with the idea of beginner's mind. You know, we put such an emphasis on beginner's mind, and a shallow reading of that would be that state of mind when you come in the door is something that you should try to retain with all of its limits and confusion and, you know, gaining ideas and so forth. And obviously that's not quite right. And I feel like I gradually came to understand that the core reason why I was coming back over the months and years was really always present. And it was just kind of covered up by all of those smaller ideas that I thought were motivating me to come in the first place. And to me, that's what we really mean by beginner's mind, is that there's a seed in that frame of mind when you first come to practice that grows, and gradually those other things fall away. And I just wonder if that resonates at all with your feeling about how your practice has developed since it started with that strange feeling that you were in this funny room with all of these odd people.
Yeah, definitely the bait and switch thing certainly seems apt, not a deliberate thing, but having like sharply pivoted from the things that brought you through the door to other things that keep you coming back through it or keep you there. I think that's okay, right? And seems extremely common, like back to Valerie's quote a bit, you know, people don't come because their life is going swimmingly and they're trying to optimize for enlightenment. They're suffering one way or another. Yeah, I hadn't thought about the beginner's mind thing that you said. I guess I'd never equated beginner's mind with the bait and switch thing. So like the thing that brought you there being different from the thing that keeps you there. Beginner's mind I've always thought of as being that kind of naive and open and not preconceived approach to practice, and maybe stopping short of like the very specific things that brought you in the door. Yeah. But as with all these things, the putting words to it and the language part is always hard. I like the line, I think it's also from the Song of the Jewel Mary Samadhi, the meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. So you put these things into words and they kind of tease at what you're really trying to feel or say.
Yeah, I love that phrase too. The meaning is not in the words, but it responds to the inquiring impulse. That is really says a lot about the practice.
Yeah.
It sort of fits together with that wonderful title of one of my favorite books, You Have to Say Something.
Thinking about the Heart Sutra and the different parts of it, because I have like spent some time studying the things that we say a lot. It's a bit like the, why am I doing this bowing? What's this about? And I had similar kinds of feelings about, why are we saying all this stuff? What does it mean? Because it can be quite impenetrable. So I bought some books and read about it, and I really enjoyed that process. And in the Heart Sutra, I remember at first, this thing that really caught me was the bit about with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita, and thus the mind is without hindrance, and without hindrance there is no fear. It's like, whoa, that's amazing. This kind of really captivated by this notion of there being no fear. It's like, give me some of that. I like that. And then over the course of time, different parts of it kind of coming in more sharply in and out of focus or being more meaningful. And there being another point later on for that second line, right at the beginning, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing prajnaparamita, just the word deeply would kind of really catch me. And so I kind of like the way that over the course of time, there's multiple bait and switches, there's different angles, different lenses that light you up.
Yeah, I understand what you mean about the Heart Sutra. When I first started practice, when I look back on it, I'm just very thankful that a sort of literal misreading of the Heart Sutra didn't send me screaming out the door, running away. Life is empty, it's all meaningless, but just say your magic mantra and it will all be okay. I mean, that's not what it means at all, but it's easy for somebody coming in the door to misunderstand. And gradually, as you say, you just gain more and more insight and meaning from it as the years go by.
Next, we have Diane.
I was struck by what you said about all these weird people. And I can understand, because we do. But then when you started to come to breakfast and you became such a part of that and bringing those quiche and everything. And I love what you said about how we each bring something to the table and then we all share that. And then it all becomes a part of us, and how that was an image for you of Sangha. And I'm struck by how you pick out different phrases from the chants and from this Heart Sutra. And because you have been chanting every Saturday for us so beautifully, I wonder if the chanting that you do brings new meaning or different meanings each time you chant it. And do you think chanting it aloud rather than sitting and studying and thinking about the words, which can be so elusive, I wonder if the chanting has really helped your understanding and helped them become more of a part of you. And then the other thing is that I have to say, I've been coming to Kanando for a very long time, and I've seen many people come and many people getting really involved. And so I'm always curious about what keeps people coming back. And then I'm also curious about what makes them go away. And so there's all of that. I guess there's two questions about your chanting aloud and the meaning of the words. And then also, I'm just curious, what keeps us coming back and what makes us go away?
Thanks, Diane. They're great questions. From the chanting, I think the physical thing, like I mentioned, the physical embodiment of all of this stuff seems like a key part of the way this stuff works. Something that I miss is actually participating in the chanting as a group in the Zendo. It's great that we can do this stuff on Zoom, but that physical experience is really different, especially given on Saturdays that I have been in Kokyo like every week for a year or a couple of instances. I don't actually hear anybody else. The only person I hear is myself. And I guess, at least for all of you, you're hearing yourself and one other person. And I think the most immersive, because I've also memorized most of the chants, and I have spent time getting familiar with them and having them, like, it's nice to have those phrases there to come to life in your mind as you're going about doing stuff. But chanting with the group without the book, not being the Gogyo, not kind of performing in any way, and just being part of that kind of group experience, I think is a great experience. And maybe I like that stuff anyway. I've been in choirs and orchestras and other things like that, so I quite like that group participative thing. Yeah. But it's a bit different when there's only one note, the same thing over and over. Yeah, I think the physical part of the chanting thing has been a really important part of unlocking the whole experience. So I don't know if you had anything else to say on that before we talk about the other thing. So then why do we stay? And why do people go? Because I can only speak for myself. Maybe things I have seen. I feel like once you're in something, and especially this kind of community where, you know, nobody's paid to do anything, and it's very few people are, you know, really have this job or this responsibility. Everybody has to club together to make stuff work. Yeah, I feel compelled to contribute, whether it's bringing some strawberries to breakfast, or, you know, just getting more involved in doing stuff. So personally, I've come to care a lot about how well we function as a community, and how well we can support the things that we do. And obviously this has been like a weird year. And so we've had to get especially creative and make some tricky compromises. It felt like something I could do to try and support those conversations and show up on Saturdays or in the mornings or whatever. Because that's my experience. And why do people leave? Well, I've moved 50 miles away, not super far, but I guess I do feel like the area where Canando sits does have a current of people moving through the area. It is kind of transient for many people in some ways. It's an expensive place to live, and so that makes it hard, I think, for a lot of people to stay over time. And so I can imagine that part of the community is that kind of people are in the area for a few years and get engaged and then kind of move on to the next chapter of their lives. And then maybe for other people as well, like maybe something doesn't catch the same way. So maybe you do come with your acute suffering and work through it. And that's enough. What do you think?
I guess it's different for everyone. It sounds like you feel you have something to contribute, and you feel there's value in that. And so that keeps you connected. I guess there's many different reasons. As you say, people come with suffering and maybe they resolve something and it's time to move on. I don't know. When I came to Canando, I just felt like I came home, you know, like it just felt correct. It felt right. And like any organization, it's made up of personalities, right? And when you have personalities and they interact, sometimes you have conflict and disagreement. And I think if our practice can keep informing us of why we're here and why we came and move beyond that and not get caught up in that. And remember, our practice is primary. And somehow that helps us to stay. You certainly have a lot to contribute and appreciate all you've contributed. So thank you.
Next we have Teresa.
You know, everybody seems to have paid a lot of attention to your comment about the weirdness. And I have to say that for me, that was very, I don't know if liberating is the word, but it was nice. I didn't see it as a negative thing in my case. Mm-hmm. One thing that I really appreciated always from Zen circles is the fact that we can stay in silence and there is no discomfort, you know. So sometimes at Starbucks, everybody's quiet and it's fine. Yeah. We don't have to talk. It's, in many other situations, people feel a little bit uncomfortable, you know, if there is silence, that you need to fill the space. So I like that, you know, and the fact that a lot of the times when we are at Canada, we are quiet, you don't have to say anything. Mm-hmm. I like that. And the weirdness is kind of liberating because it's a way, the way I experienced it, it's a way for me to also be myself.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this morning when I woke up, the first thing that I thought since I was waking up to kind of attend your talk, I thought I couldn't do what Craig does, meaning the energy that you have brought to the reopening committee and the level of detail this past year without knowing that, you know, we are not going to reopen. Still, you do all these elaborate documents and you do all the research about the latest trends and all of that. And it's amazing. I really appreciate that. And it really shows your love for the place. When you were talking, I like what you said about the physical space